Chapter 5. The sun beat down from its noonday height upon Bombay, imposing a silence upon that teeming city, so that even in the deepest bazaars the steady beat of the surf could be heard, the panting of the Indian Ocean, dull ochre under a sky too hot to be blue, a sky waiting for the southwest monsoon, and at the same moment, far, far to the westward, far over Africa and beyond, it heaved up to the horizon and sent a fiery dart to strike the limp royals and to gallants of the surprise as she lay becalmed on the oily swell a little north of the line and some 30 degrees west of Greenwich. The blaze of light moved down to the topsails, to the courses, shone upon the snowy deck, and it was day. Suddenly the whole of the east was day. The sun lit the sky to the zenith, and for a moment the night could be seen over the starboard bow, fleeting away towards America. Mars, setting a hand's breadth above the western rim, went out abruptly. The entire bowl of the sky grew brilliant, and the dark sea returned to its daily blue, deep blue.
"By your leave, sir,"
cried the captain of the afterguard, bending over Dr. Maturin and shouting into the bag that covered his head.
"If you please, now."
"What is it?"
asked Stephen at last, with a bestial snarl.
"Nigh on 4 bells, sir."
"Well, what of it? Sunday morning, surely to God, and you would be at your holy stoning?"
The bag, worn against the moon pall, stifled his words, but not the whining tone of a man jerked from total relaxation and an erotic dream. The frigate was stifling between decks. She was more than ordinarily overcrowded with Mr. Stanhope and his suite, and he had slept on deck, walked upon by each changing watch.
"These old pitch spots," said the captain of the afterguard, in a wheedling, reasoning voice. "What would the quarter-deck look like with all these old pitch spots when we come to rig church?"
Then, as Dr. Maturin showed signs of going to sleep again, he returned to,
"By your leave, sir, by your leave, if you please."
In the heat, the tar on the rigging melted and fell on the deck. The pitch used in caulking the seams melted too, and Stephen, plucking off his bag, saw that they had scrubbed, sanded, and holy-stoned all round him, that he was in a spotted island, surrounded by impatient seamen, eager to be done with their work so that they could shave and put on their Sunday clothes. Sleep was hopelessly gone. He stood up, took his head right out of the bag, muttering,
"Nope. Peace in this infernal hulk, or tub, persecution, Judaic superstitious ritual cleanliness, archaic fools,"
and walked stiffly to the side. But as he stood, the sun shot a grateful living warmth right into his bones. A cock in the nearby coop crowed, standing on tiptoe, and instantly a hen cried that she had laid an egg, an egg. He stretched, gazed about him, met the stony, disapproving faces of the afterguard, and realized that the gumminess of his feet was caused by tar, pitch, and resin on his shoes. A trail of dirty footsteps led across the clean deck from the place where he had slept to the rail where he now stood.
"Oh, I beg your pardon, Franklin," he cried. "I have dirtied the floor, I find. Come, give me a scraper, sand, a broom."
The harsh looks vanished.
"No, no," they cried. "It was only a little pitch, not dirt. They would have it off in a moment."
But Stephen had caught up a small holy stone, and he was earnestly spreading the pitch far, deep, and wide, surrounded by a ring of anxious, flustered seamen when 4 bells struck, and to the infinite distress of the afterguard, a huge shadow fell across the deck. The captain, stark naked and carrying a towel.
"Good morning, Doctor," he said. "What are you about?"
"Good morning, my dear," said Stephen. "It is this damned spot, but I shall have him out. I shall extirpate this spot."
"What do you say to a swim?"
"With all my heart, in less than a moment. I have a theory, a trifle of sand there, if you please, a small knife. No, no, my hypothesis was unsound. Perhaps aqua regia, spirits of salt."
"Franklin, show the doctor how we do it in the Navy. My dear fellow, if I might suggest taking off your shoes, then they might not have to scrub right through the deck and leave His Excellency without a roof to his head."
"An excellent suggestion," said Stephen.
He tiptoed barefoot to a carronade and sat looking at his upturned soles.
Marshall tells us that in his day the ladies of the town had sequime engraved upon their sandals, from which it is reasonable to conclude that Rome was uncommon muddy, for sand would scarcely hold the print. I shall swim the whole length of the ship today."
Jack stepped onto the western rail and looked down into the water. It was so clear that he could see the light passing under the frigate's keel. Her hull projected a purple underwater shadow westwards, sharp head and stern, but vague beneath because of her trailing skirts of weeds, a heavy growth in spite of her new copper, for they had been a great while south of the tropic. No ominous lurking shape, however, only a school of shining little fishes and a few swimming crabs.
"Come on, then," he said, diving in.
The sea was warmer than the air, but there was refreshment in the rush of bubbles along his skin, the water tearing through his hair, the clean salt taste in his mouth. Looking up, he saw the silvery undersurface, the Surprise's hull hanging down through it, and the clean copper near her waterline reflecting an extraordinary violet into the sea. Then a white explosion as Stephen shattered the mirror, plunging bottom foremost from the gangway 20 feet above. His impetus bore him down and down, and Jack noticed that he was holding his nose. He was holding it still when he came to the surface, but then relinquished it to strike out in his usual way. Short, cataleptic jerks, with his eyes tightly shut and his mouth clenched in savage determination. Some inherent leading quality about his person kept him very low in the water, his nose straining just clear of the surface, but he had made great progress since the day Jack had first dipped him over the side in a running bowline 3 days out from Madeira, 2,000 miles and many weeks sailing to the north, or rather many weeks of trimming sail, hoping to catch a hint of a breeze in their royals and flying kites, and whistling for a wind. For although they had picked up the northeast trades off the Canaries, and had run down 25 degrees of latitude, day after day of sweet sailing, hardly touching a sheet or a brace, and often logging 200 miles between noon and noon, the sun growing higher with every latitude they took, they had run into the variables far north of the line, and hitherto they had not had a hint of the southeast trades, in spite of the fact that at this time of the year they were to be expected well above the equator. 300 miles now of calm or of capricious, often baffling breezes, weeks of towing the ship's head round to take advantage of them, heaving round the yards, getting the fire engine into the tops to wet the sails, buckets of water whipped up to the royals to help them draw, only to find the breeze die away, or desert them to ruffle the sea 10 miles away. But mostly dead calm, and the Surprise drifting imperceptibly westwards on the equatorial current, very slowly turning upon herself. A lifeless sea, the swell invisible but for the sickening heave of the horizon as she rolled with no sail to steady her. Almost no birds, very few fishes, the single turtle and yesterday's booby, a 9 days wonder, never a sail under the pure dome of the sky. The sun beating down 12 hours a day, and they were running short of water. How long would the short allowance last? He dismissed the calculations for the moment and swam towards the boat, towing behind, where Stephen was clinging to the gunwale and calling out something about the Hellespont, incomprehensible for the gasping.
"Did you see me?" he cried as Jack came nearer. "I swam the entire length, 420 strokes without a pause."
"Well done,"
said Jack, swinging himself into the boat with an easy roll.
"Well done indeed."
Each stroke must have propelled Stephen a little less than 3 inches, for the Surprise was only a 28-gun ship, a sixth rate of 579 tons, the kind so harshly called a jackass frigate by those not belonging to her.
"Should you like to come aboard? Let me give you a hand."
"No, no," cried Stephen, drawing away. "I shall manage perfectly well. For the moment I'm taking my ease. I thank you, however."
He hated to be helped. Even at the beginning of the voyage, when his poor twisted limbs would hardly carry him along the deck, he had detested it. And yet daily he had made a stated number of turns from the taffrail to the break of the head and back again. Daily, after they had reached the height of Lisbon, he had crawled into the mizzen-top, allowing no man but Bondon to attend him, while Jack watched in agony from below, and two hands darted about on deck with a fender to break his fall. And every evening he forced his mutilated hand to skip up and down the muted strings of his cello, while his set face turned a paler grey. But Lord, what progress he had made! This last frantic swim would have been infinitely beyond his strength only a month ago, to say nothing of their time in Portsmouth.
"What were you saying about the Hellespont?"
he asked. "How wide is it?"
"Why, not above a mile or so. Point-blank range from either side."
"The next time we go up the Mediterranean," said Stephen, "I shall swim it."
"I'm sure you will. If one hero could, I'm sure another can."
"Look, look! Surely that is a turn just above the horizon," cried Stephen.
"Where away?"
"There, there,"
said Stephen, releasing his hold to point. He sank at once, bubbling, but his pointing hand remained above the surface. Jack seized it, heaved him inboard, and said,
"Come, let us dart up the stern ladder. I can smell our coffee, and we have a busy morning ahead of us."
He took the painter, pulled the boat up to the frigate's stern, and guided the ladder into Stephen's grasp. The bell struck, and at the pipe of the boatswain's call, the hammocks came flying up, close on 200 of them, to be stowed with lightning rapidity into the nettings, with their numbers all turned the same way. And in the rushing current of seamen, Jack stood tall and magnificent in a flowered silk dressing gown, looking sharply up and down the deck. The smell of coffee and bacon was almost more than he could bear, but he meant to see this operation through. It was by no means as brisk as he could wish, and some of those hammocks were flabby, dropsical objects. Hervey would have to start using a hoop again. Pullings, who had the morning watch, was forward, causing a hammock to be relashed in an un-Sunday tone of voice. He was obviously of the same opinion. It was Jack's usual custom to invite the officer of the morning watch and one of the youngsters to breakfast with him, but this was to be a particularly social day later on, and Callow, the squeaker in question, had burst out into an eruption of adolescent spots, enough to put a man off his appetite. Dear Pullings would certainly forgive him. An eddy in the tide brought a civilian staggering over the quarter-deck. This was Mr. Atkins, the envoy's secretary. An odd little man, who had already given them a deal of trouble, strange notions of his own importance, of the accommodation possible in a small frigate, and of sea-going customs, sometimes high and offended, sometimes over-familiar.
"Good morning, sir,"
said Jack.
"Good morning, Captain,"
cried Atkins, falling into step as Jack started his habitual pacing. No idea of the sacrosanctity of a captain, and in spite of his before-breakfast shrewishness, Jack could hardly tell him of it himself.
"I have good news for you. His Excellency is far better today, far better than we have seen him since the beginning of the trip. I dare say he will take the air presently. And I think I may venture to hint," he whispered, taking Jack's reluctant arm and breathing into his face, "that an invitation to dinner might prove acceptable."
"I am delighted to hear that he is better,"
said Jack, disengaging himself.
"And I trust that we may soon have the pleasure of his company."
"Oh, you need not be anxious. You need not make any great preparations. H.E. is quite simple. No distance or pride. A plain dinner will do very well. Shall we say today?"
"I think not,"
said Jack, looking curiously at the little man by his side.
"I dine with the gunroom on Sunday. It is the custom."
"But surely, Captain—" "Surely no previous engagement can stand in the way. His Majesty's direct representative."
"Naval custom is holy at sea, Mr. Atkins,"
said Jack, turning away and raising his voice.
"Port up there! Mind what you are about with that Euphrow! Mr. Callow, when Mr. Pullings comes aft, be so good as to give him my compliments, and I should be glad if he would breakfast with me. I hope you will join us, Mr. Callow."
Breakfast at last, and the tide of Jack's native good humour rose. They were cramped, the four of them, in the coach. The great cabin had been given over to Mr. Stanhope, but confinement was part of naval life, and easing himself round in his chair, he stretched his legs, lit his cigar, and said,
"Tuck in, youngster. Don't mind me. Look, there is a whole pile of bacon under that cover. It would be a sad shame to send it away."
In the agreeable pause that followed, broken only by the steady champ of the midshipman's jaws as he engulfed 27 rashers, they heard the cry pass through the ship.
"D'ye hear there? Fore and aft! Clean for muster at 5 bells! Duck frocks and white trousers! D'ye hear there? Clean shirt and a shave at 5 bells!
They also heard, clear through the thin cabin bulkhead, the metallic voice of Mr. Atkins apparently haranguing his chief, and Mr. Stanhope's quiet replies. The envoy was a remote, gentle, grey man, very well-bred, and it was a wonder that he should ever have attached such a bustling fellow to his service. Mr. Stanhope had been ill when he came aboard, had suffered abominably from seasickness as far as Gibraltar, then again right down to the Canaries, and he relapsed in the heavy swell of the doldrums when the Surprise, log-like on the heaving sea, often seemed to be about to roll her masts out. This relapse had been accompanied by a fit of the gout, which, flying to his stomach, had kept him in his cabin. They had seen very little of the poor gentleman.
"Tell me, Mr. Callow," said Jack, partly out of a wish not to hear too much, and partly to make his guest welcome, "how is the midshipman's mess coming along? I've not seen your ram this week or more."
The ancient creature, palmed off upon the unsuspecting caterer as a hogget, had been a familiar sight, stumping slowly about upon the deck.
"Pretty low, sir," said Callow, withdrawing his hand from the bread barge. "We ate him in 70 North, and now we are down to the hen. But we give her all our bargemen, sir, and she may lay an egg."
"You ain't down to Miller's, then?" said Pullings.
"Oh, yes, we are, sir," cried the midshipman. "Threepence they have reached, which is a goddamned... a crying shame."
"What are Miller's?" asked Stephen.
"Rats, saving your presence," said Jack. "Only we call 'em Miller's to make 'em eat better, and perhaps because they are dusty, too, from getting into the flour and peas."
"My rats will not touch anything but the best biscuit, slightly moistened with melted butter. They are obese. Their proud bellies drag the ground."
"Rats, doctor?" cried Pullings. "Why do you keep rats?"
"I wish to see how they come along, to watch their motions," said Stephen.
He was, in fact, conducting an experiment, feeding them with madder to see how long it took to penetrate their bones, but he did not mention this. His was a secretive mind. The area of reticence had grown and grown, and now it covered the globular, kitten-sized creatures that dozed through the hot nights and blazing days in his storeroom.
"Miller's,"
said Jack, his mind roaming back to his famished youth.
"In the aftermost carlin culver of the larboard berth there is a hole where we used to put a piece of cheese and catch them in a noose as they poked their heads out on their way along the channel to the bread room. 3 or 4 a night in the middle watch we used to catch on the Leeward Islands station. Heneage Dundas," nodding to Stephen, "used to eat the cheese afterwards."
"Was you a midshipman in the Surprise, sir?" cried young Callow, amazed, amazed.
If he had thought about it at all, he would have supposed that post-captains sprang fully armed from the forehead of the Admiralty.
"Indeed I was,"
said Jack.
"Good heavens, sir! She must be very, very old. The oldest ship in the fleet, I dare say."
"Well," said Jack, "she is pretty old, too. We took her early in the last war. She was the French Unité, and she was no chicken then. Could you manage another egg?"
Callow leapt, jerked almost out of his chair by Pullings's under-table hint, changed his "Yes, sir, if you please," to "No, sir, thank you very much," and stood up.
"In that case," said Jack, "perhaps you'll be so good as to desire your messmates to come into the cabin with their logs."
The rest of the morning, until 5 bells in the forenoon watch, he spent with the midshipmen, then with the boatswain, gunner, carpenter, and purser, going over their accounts. Stores were well enough, plenty of beef, pork, peas, and biscuit for 6 months, but all the cheese and butter had to be condemned. Hardened as he was, Jack recoiled from the samples Mr. Bowes showed him, and worse, far worse, the water was dangerously short. Some vile jobbery in the cooperage had provided the Surprise with a ground tier of casks that drank almost as much as the ship's company, and the new-fangled iron tank had silently leaked its heart out. He was still deep in paper when Killick came in, carrying his best uniform coat, and jerked his chin at him.
"Mr. Bowes, we must finish this later," said Jack.
And as he dressed, the good broadcloth seemed 3 inches thick in this shattering heat, he thought about the water, about his position, so far westward after these weeks of drifting that when they did pick up the southeast trades, he might find it difficult to weather Cape San Roque in Brazil. He could see the Surprise exactly on the chart. His repeated lunars agreed closely with the chronometers and with the master's and Mr. Hervey's reckonings, and on the chart he could see the coast of Brazil not much above 500 miles away. Furthermore, near the line the trades often came from, due south. While he was worrying with these problems and his buttons, neckcloth and sword belt, he felt the ship heel to the wind, heel again, and very gently she began to speak, the sound of live water running along her side. He glanced at the compass overhead, west-southwest, a half-west. Would it die at once? When he came onto the crowded, even hotter deck, it was still blowing.
She just had steerageway, as close-hauled as she could be, yards braced up, twanging taut, sails like boards. His plump, myopic first lieutenant, Mr. Hervey, sweating in his uniform, smiled nervously at him, though with more confidence than usual. Surely this was right.
"Very good, Mr. Hervey," he said. "This is what we've been whistling for, eh? Long may it last. Perhaps we might keep her a little off, fore and main sheets, give her a fathom."
Hervey, thank God, was not one of your touchy first lieutenants, needing perpetual management. He had no great opinion of his own seamanship, nor had anyone else, and so long as he was treated kindly, he never took offence. Hervey relayed the orders. The Surprise began to slip through the water as though she meant to cut the line diagonally before nightfall, and Jack said,
"I believe we may beat to divisions."
The first lieutenant turned to Nichols, the officer of the watch, and said,
"Beat to divisions?"
Nichols said to the mate of the watch,
"Mr. Babington, beat to divisions."
And Babington opened his mouth to address the drummer. But before any sound emerged, the marine, with a set and hieratic expression, woke the thunder in his drum, tan-tar-ra-tan, and all the officers hurried off to their places. As a warning or advertisement, the drum beat was a failure. There being nothing unexpected about it whatsoever, the ship's company had been lining the quarter-deck, the gangways and the forecastle for some time, standing along the appointed seams in the deck, while the midshipmen fussed about them, trying to make them stand upright, keep in order and toe the line, tweaking neckerchiefs, lanyards, hat-ribbons. But the muster was understood by all hands to be a formal ceremony, as formal as a dance, a slow, solemn dance, with the captain opening the ball. This he did as soon as all the officers had reported to Hervey, and Hervey had informed him of the fact. He turned first to the marines. From their position on the after part of the quarter-deck, they had no benefit from the awning, but stood there in rigid pipe clay and scarlet perfection, their muskets and faces blazing in the sun. He returned their officers' salute and walked slowly along the line. His opinion on the set of a leather stock, the amount of powder in their hair, the number and brilliance of their buttons was of no value. In any case, Etheridge, their lieutenant, was a competent officer, and it would certainly be impossible to fault him. But Jack's role in all this was to be the eye of God, and he carried out his inspection with impersonal gravity. As a man, he felt for the marines broiling there. As a captain, he left them to their motionless suffering. The tar was already dripping on the awnings as the sun gathered even greater strength, and with the words,
"Very creditable, Mr. Etheridge,"
he turned to the first division of the seamen, the forecastlemen, headed by Mr. Nichols, the second lieutenant. They were the best seamen in the ship, all rated able, most of them middle-aged, some quite elderly, but none in all those years at sea had yet learnt to stand to attention. Their straw hats flew off at his approach, and their toes remained fairly near the line, but this was the height of their formality. They smoothed down their hair, hitched up their loose, white, homemade trousers, looked round, smiled, coughed, gaped about, staring. Very unlike the soldiers. A comforting set of forecastlemen, he reflected, as he passed slowly along the silent deck with Mr. Hervey. Seamen salted to the bone. Several bald pates, strangely white in the suffused glare under the awning, a striking contrast with their dark brown faces. But all with their remaining hair gathered in a long tail behind, sometimes helped out with tow. Such a mass of sea-going knowledge there. But as he returned Nichols's parting salute, he noticed, with a sudden shock, that the lieutenant's face was ill-shaved, and that the man himself, his linen and his uniform, were dirty. He had scarcely ever seen such a thing before in an officer, nor had he often seen such a look of veiled indifference and weariness. On to the fortopman under Pullings, who greeted him as though they had never met before, with a "Present, properly dressed and clean, sir," and fell in behind the captain and the first lieutenant. Here was worldliness. Here was sinful vanity. All hands were in their best clothes, of course, snowy trousers and frocks with blue open collars, but the younger fortopmen had ribbons sewn into their seams, gorgeous handkerchiefs shawl-wise round their necks, curling sidelocks falling low and gold earrings gleaming among them.
"What is the matter with Kellinach, Mr. Pullings?"
he asked, stopping. "He fell off the t'gallant yardarm on Friday, sir." Yes, Jack remembered the fall. A spectacular, but a lucky one, a direct plunge on the roll that sent him clear of spars and ropes into the sea, from which he was fished with no trouble of any kind. It could hardly account for this glum look, dull eye, lifelessness.
Questions yielded nothing. He was,
"Quite well, sir. Prime."
But Jack had seen that puffed face and sunken eye before. He had seen it too often. And when he came to Babington's Wasters and saw it again in Garland, an innocent whose lifetime at sea had not taught him to wield more than a swab, and that badly, a gigantic simpleton who always laughed and simpered whenever he was mustered, he said to Hervey,
"What do you make of this man?"
The first lieutenant thrust his head forward to focus Garland's face and replied,
"That is Garland, sir. A good fellow. Attentive to his duty, but not very bright."
No blushing merriment, no sidling, followed this remark. The innocent stood like an ox. Jack passed on to the gunners, honest slow-bellies for the most part, whom he had found in the usual state of neglect, but whose lives he would make a misery until they learnt to serve their pieces as they ought to serve their God. Young Conroy was the last in the division, a blue-eyed youth as tall as Jack, but much slimmer, with an absurdly beautiful, mild, smooth girl's face. His beauty left Jack totally unmoved. This could not be said for all his shipmates, but the bone ring that fastened his handkerchief did not. On the outward face of the bone, a shark's vertebra, Conroy had worked so perfect a likeness of the Sophie, Jack's first command, that he recognized her at once. Conroy was probably related to someone who had belonged to her. Yes, there had been a quartermaster of the same name, a married man who always remitted his pay and prize money home. Was he sailing with an old shipmate's son? Age. Age. Dear me. This was no time to speak, and in any case Conroy, though not dumb, had such a shocking stutter as to make him nearly so, but he would look into the muster book when he had a moment. Now the forecastle, where he was received by the boatswain, the carpenter, and the gunner, suffering and motionless in their rarely worn uniforms, and at once the oppressive feeling of great age fell away, for these were the frigate's standing officers, and one of them, Rattray, had been with her from the beginning. He had been boatswain of the Surprise when Jack was a master's mate in her, and Jack felt painfully young under his keen, grey, respectful but somewhat cynical eye. He felt that this eye pierced straight through his post-captain's epaulette, and did not think much of what it saw below, was not deceived by the pomp. Inwardly Jack agreed, but withdrawing into his role he stiffened as they exchanged the formal courtesies, and passed on with some relief to the master-at-arms and the ship's boys, taking a mean revenge in reflecting once more that Rattray had never been much of a boatswain from the point of view of discipline, and that now he was past his prime in the article of rigging, too. The boys seemed spry enough, though here again there were more spots than was usual or pleasant, and one had a monstrous black mark on the shoulder of his frock. Tar.
"Master-at-arms," said Jack. "What is the meaning of this?"
"It dropped on him from the rigging, sir, this last minute, which I see it fall."
The boy, a stunted little adenoidal creature with a permanently open mouth, looked perfectly terrified.
"Well," said Jack, "I suppose we may call it an act of God. Do not let it happen again, Peters."
Then, seeing at the edge of his official gaze that three of the boys in the back row had worked one another into a hopeless pitch of strangled mirth, mutely writhing, he passed quickly on to the larboard wasters and the afterguard. Here the quality fell off dismally. A stupid, unhandy set of lubbers on the whole, though some of the recent landsmen might improve. Most of them looked cheerful, good-natured fellows, only three or four right hard bargains from the jails. But here again he saw more gloomy, lackluster faces. The ship's company was done. Not a bad company at all, and for once he was not undermanned. But poor ailing Simmons, his predecessor, had let discipline grow slack before he died. The months in Portsmouth had done no good, and Hervey was not the man to build up an efficient crew. He was an amiable, conscientious fellow, very good company when he could overcome his diffidence, and a profound mathematician, but he could not see from one end of the ship to the other, and even if he had had the eyes of a lynx, he was no seaman. Still worse, he had no authority. His kindliness and ignorance had played old Harry with the Surprise, and anyhow it would have called for an exceptional officer to cope with the loss of half the frigate's people, drafted off by the port admiral, and their replacement by the crew of the Raccoon, turned over to the Surprise in a body on returning from a 4 years' commission on the North American station, without being allowed to set foot on shore. The Raccoons and the Surprises, and the small draft of landsmen, still had not mixed. There were still unpleasant jealousies, and the ratings were often absurdly wrong. The captain of the foretop did not know his business, for example, and as for their gunnery,
But this was not what he was worrying about as he walked into the galley. He had an enchanting ship, frail and elderly though she might be, some good officers and good material. No, what haunted him was the thought of scurvy. But he might be mistaken. These dull looks might have 100 other causes, and surely it was too early in the voyage for scurvy to break out. The heat in the galley brought him up all standing. It had been gasping hot on deck, even with the blessed breeze. Here it was like walking straight into a baker's oven. But the three-legged cook, three-legged because both his own had been shot away on the glorious 1st of June, and he had supplemented the two provided by the hospital with a third ingeniously seized to his bottom to prevent him from plunging into his cauldrons or his range in a heavy sea. The range was now cherry pink in the gloom, and the cook's face shone with sweat.
"Very trim, Johnson. Capital,"
said Jack, backing a step.
"Aren't you going to inspect the coppice, sir?"
cried the cook, his brilliant smile vanishing, so that in the comparative darkness his whole face seemed to disappear.
"Certainly I am,"
said Jack, drawing on the ceremonial white glove. With this he ran his hand round the gleaming coppers, gazed at his fingers as though he really expected to find them deeply crusted with old filth and grease. A drop of sweat trembled on the end of his nose, and more coursed down inside his coat, but he gazed at the peas soup, the ovens, and the 200-weight of plum duff, Sunday duff, before making his way to the sick bay, where Dr. Maturin and his raw-boned Scotch assistant were waiting for him. Having made the round of the cots, one broken arm, one hernia with pox, four plain poxes, with what he intended to be encouraging remarks, "Looking better, soon be fit and well, back with their messmates for crossing the line," he stood under the opening of the air sail, profiting by the relative coolness of 105 degrees, and said privately to Stephen,
"Pray go along the divisions with Mr. Mallister while I'm below. Some of the men seem to me to have an ugly look of the scurvy. I hope I'm wrong. It is far too early, but it looks damnably like it."
Now the berth deck, with an ill-looking cat that sat defying them with studied insolence, its arms folded, and its particular friend, an equally mangy green parrot, lying on its side, prostrated with heat, that said,
"Eringo brach,"
in a low tone once or twice as Jack and Hervey paced along with bowed heads, past the spotless mess tables, kids, benches, chests, the whole clean-swept deck checkered with brilliant light from the gratings and the hatchways. Nothing much wrong here, nor in the midshipman's berth, nor, of course, in the gunroom. But in the sail-room, where the boatswain joined them again, a very shocking sight. Mould on the first staysail he turned over, and worse as the others were brought out. This was lubber's work, slovenly and extremely dangerous. Poor Hervey wrung his hands, and the boatswain, though made of sterner stuff, was quickly reduced to much the same condition. Jack's unfeigned anger, his utter contempt for the excuses offered.
"It happens so quick, near the line. No fresh water to get the salt out. The salt draws the damp. Hard to fold them just so with all these awnings,"
made a shattering impression on Rattray. His remarks upon the efficiency required in a man of war were delivered in little more than a conversational tone, but they were not inaudible, and when he emerged, after having looked at the holds, cable tiers, and forepeak, the frigate's people had an air of mixed delight and apprehension. They were charmed that the boatswain had copped it. All of them, that is to say, who would not be spending their holy Sunday afternoon in
"rousing them all out, sir, every last storm staysail, every drabbler, every bonnet, do you hear me now?"
But apprehensive, lest their own sins be discovered, lest they cop it next, for this skipper was a bleeding Tartar, mate, a right hard horse. However, he returned to the quarter-deck without biting or savaging anyone in his path, peered up between the awnings at the pyramid of canvas still just drawing, and said to Mr. Hervey,
"We will rig church, if you please."
Chairs and benches appeared on the quarter-deck. The cutlass rack, decently covered with signal flags, became a reading desk. The ship's bell began to toll. The seamen flocked aft. The officers and the civilians of the envoy's suite stood at their places, waiting for Mr. Stanhope, who walked slowly to his chair on the captain's right, propped on the one side by his chaplain, and on the other by his secretary. He looked grey and wan among all these mahogany-red faces, almost ghost-like. He had never wanted to go to Kampong. He had never even known where Kampong was until they gave him this mission, and he hated the sea. But now that the Surprise was sailing on the gentle breeze, her role was far less distressing, hardly perceptible so long as he kept his eyes from the rail and the horizon beyond, and the familiar Church of England service was a comfort to him, among all these strange intricacies of rope, wood, and canvas, and in this intolerably heated, unbreathable air. He followed its course with an attention as profound as that of the seamen. He joined in the well-known psalms in a faint tenor, drowned by the deep thunder of the captain on his left, and yet sweetly prolonged in the remote celestial voice of the Welsh lookout high on the Ferroyal Jacks. But when the parson announced the text of his sermon, Mr. Stanhope's mind wandered far away to the coolness of his parish church at home, the dim light of sapphires in the east window, the tranquillity of the family tombs, and he closed his eyes. He wandered alone. The moment the Reverend Mr. White said, "The sixth verse of Psalm 75, promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south," the flagging devotion of the midshipmen to leeward and of the lieutenants to windward revived, sprang to vivid life. They sat forward in attitudes of tense expectancy, and Jack, who might be called upon to preach himself if he were to command a ship without a chaplain, reflected,
"A flaming good text, upon my word."
Yet when at length it appeared that promotion cameth not from the north either, as the sharper midshipmen had supposed, but rather from a course of conduct that Mr. White proposed to describe under 10 main heads, they slowly sank back. And when even this promotion was found to be not of the present world, they abandoned him altogether in favour of reflections upon their dinner, their Sunday dinner, the plum duff that was simmering under the equatorial sun with no more than a glowing cinder to keep it on the boil. They glanced up at the sails, flapping now as the breeze died away. They pondered on the likelihood of a stunsail being put over the side to swim in.
"If I can square old Babington," thought Callow, who had also been invited to dine in the gun-room at 2 o'clock, "I shall get two dinners. I can dart below the moment we have shot the sun, and—"
"On deck there!"
came from the sky.
"On deck there! Sail ho!"
"Where away?"
called Jack as the chaplain broke off.
"2 points on the starboard bow, sir!"
"Keep her away, Davidge,"
said Jack to the man at the wheel, who, though in the midst of the congregation, was not of it, and who had never opened his mouth for hymn, psalm, response, or prayer.
"Carry on, Mr. White, if you please. I beg your pardon."
Looks darted to and fro across the quarterdeck. Wild surmise, intense excitement. Jack felt extreme moral pressure building up all round him, but, apart from a quick glance at his watch, he remained immovable, listening to the chaplain with his head slightly on one side, grave, attentive.
"Tenthly and lastly," said Mr. White, speaking faster.
Below, in the airy, shadowed, empty berth deck, Stephen walked up and down, reading the chapter on scurvy in Blaine's Diseases of Seamen. He heard the hail, paused again, and said to the cat,
"How is this? The cry of a sail, and no turmoil, no instant activity. What is afoot?"
The cat pursed its lips. Stephen reopened his book and read in it until he heard the 200-fold
"Amen"
above his head. On deck, the church was disappearing in the midst of a universal excited buzz, glances at the captain, glances over the hammock cloths towards the horizon where a flash of white could be seen on the rise. The chairs and benches were hurried below, the hassocks turned back to wads for the great guns, the cutlasses resumed their plain Old Testament character. But since the first 9 heads of Mr. White's discourse had taken a long, long time, almost till noon itself, sextants and quadrants already came tumbling up before the prayer books had vanished. The sun was close to the zenith, and this was nearly the moment to take his altitude. The quarter-deck awning was rolled back, the pitiless, naked light beat down, and as the master, his mates, the midshipmen, the first lieutenant and the captain took their accustomed stations for this high moment, the beginning of the naval day, they had no more shadow than a little pool of darkness at their feet. It was a solemn 5 minutes, particularly for the midshipmen, their captain insisted upon accurate observation, and yet no one seemed to care greatly about the sun. No one, until Stephen Maturin, walking up to Jack, said,
"What is this I hear about a strange sail?"
"Just a moment,"
said Jack, stepping to the quarter-deck bulwark, raising his sextant, bringing the sun down to the horizon and noting his reading on the little ivory tablet.
"Sail? Oh, that is only St. Paul's Rocks, you know. They will not run away. If this breeze don't die on us, you will see them quite close after dinner. Prodigiously curious. Gulls, boobies, and so on.
The news instantly ran through the ship. Rocks, not ships. Any goddamned lubber as had travelled farther than Margate knew St. Paul's rocks, and all hands returned to their keen expectation of dinner, which followed immediately after the altitude. The cooks of all the messes stood with their wooden kids near the galley. The mate of the hold began the mixing of the grog, watched with intensity by the quartermasters and the purser's steward. The smell of rum mingled with that of cooking and eddied about the deck. Saliva poured into 197 mouths. The boatswain stood with his caul poised on the break of the forecastle. On the gangway, the master lowered his sextant, walked aft to Mr. Hervey, and said, 12 o'clock, sir. 58 minutes north. The first lieutenant turned to Jack, took off his hat, and said, 12 o'clock, sir, if you please, and 58 minutes north. Jack turned to the officer of the watch and said,
Mr. Nichols, make it 12.
The officer of the watch called out to the mate of the watch, Make it 12. The mate of the watch said to the quartermaster,
Strike 8 bells.
The quartermaster roared at the marine sentry,
Turn the glass and strike the bell.
And at the first stroke, Nichols called along the length of the ship to the boatswain,
Pipe to dinner.
The boatswain piped, no doubt, but little did the quarterdeck hear of it, for the clash of mess kids, the roaring of the cooks, the tramp of feet, and the confused din of the various messes banging their plates. In this weather, the men dined on deck, among their guns, each mess fixing itself as accurately as possible above its own table below, and so Jack led Stephen into his cabin.
"What did you think of the people?" he asked.
"You were quite right," said Stephen. "It is scurvy. All my authorities agree. Weakness, diffused muscular pain, petechia, tender gums, ill breath, and Mallister has no doubt of it. He is an intelligent fellow, has seen many cases. I have gone into the matter, and I find that nearly all the men affected come from the Raccoon. They were months at sea before being turned over to us."
"So that is where the mischief lies," cried Jack.
"Of course. But you will be able to put them right? Oh, yes, you will set them up directly."
"I wish I could share your confidence. I wish I could feel persuaded that our lime juice were not sophisticated. Tell me, is there anything green grows upon those rocks of yours?"
"Never a blade, never a single blade," said Jack. "And no water either."
"Well," said Stephen, drawing up his shoulders, "I shall do my best with what we have."
"I'm sure you will, my dear Stephen," cried Jack,
flinging off his coat and with it part of his care. He had an unlimited faith in Stephen's powers, and although he had seen a ship's company badly hit by the disease, with hardly enough hands to win the anchor or make sail, let alone fight the ship, he thought of the 40s, of the great western gales far south of the line, with an easier mind.
"It is a great comfort to me to have you aboard. It is like sailing with a piece of the true cross."
"Stuff, stuff," said Stephen peevishly. "I do wish you would get that weak notion out of your mind. Medicine can do very little, surgery less. I can purge you, bleed you, worm you at a pinch, set your leg or take it off, and that is very nearly all. What could Hippocrates, Galen, Rhazes, what can Blaine, what can Trotter do for a carcinoma, a lupus, a sarcoma?"
He had often tried to eradicate Jack's simple faith, but Jack had seen him trepan the gunner of the Sophie, saw a hole in his skull and expose the brain, and Stephen, looking at Jack's knowing smile, his air of civil reserve, knew that he had not succeeded this time either. The Sophies, to a man, had known that if he chose, Dr. Maturin could save anyone, so long as the tide had not turned. And Jack was so thoroughly a seaman that he shared nearly all their beliefs, though in a somewhat more polished form. He said,
"What do you say to a glass of Madeira before we go to the gunroom? I believe they've killed the younger pig for us, and Madeira is a capital foundation for pork."
Madeira did very well as a foundation, Burgundy as an accompaniment, and port as a settler, though all would have been better if they had been a little under blood heat.
"How long the human frame can withstand this abuse," thought Stephen, looking round the table, "remains to be seen."
He was eating biscuit rubbed with garlic himself, and he had drunk thin, cold, black coffee, on grounds both of theory and personal practice. But as he looked round the table, he was obliged to admit that so far the frames were supporting it tolerably well. Jack, with a deep stratum of duff upon a couple of pounds of swine's flesh and root vegetables, was perhaps a little nearer apoplexy than usual, but the bright blue eyes in his scarlet face were not suffused. There was no immediate danger. The same could be said for the fat Mr. Hervey, who had eaten and drunk himself out of his habitual constraint. His round face was like the rising sun, supposing the sun to wrinkle with merriment. All the faces there, except for Nichols's, were a fine red, but Hervey's outshone the rest. There was an attaching simplicity about the First Lieutenant, no striving contention, no pretense, no sort of aggression. How would such a man behave in hand-to-hand action? Would his politeness, and Hervey was very much the gentleman, put him at a fatal disadvantage? In any event, he was quite out of place here, poor fellow, far more suitable for a parsonage or a fellowship. He was the victim of innumerable naval connections, an influential family full of admirals whose summum bonum was a flag, and who by means of book time and every other form of decent corruption meant to impel him into command at the earliest possible age. He had passed for lieutenant before a board of his grandfather's protégés, who gravely wrote that they had examined Mr. Hervey, who appears to be 20 years of age. He produceth certificates of his diligence and sobriety. He can splice knot, reef a sail, work a ship in sailing, shift his tides, keep a reckoning of a ship's way by plain sailing and mercator, observe by sun or star, and find the variation of the compass, and is qualified to do the duty of an able seaman and midshipman. All lies, but for the mathematical part, since he had almost no real sea-going experience. He would be made commander as soon as they reached his uncle, the admiral on the East India station, and a few months later he would be an anxious, ineffectual, diffident post-captain. He and the purser would have been happier if they had changed places. Bowes, the purser, had been unable to go to sea as a boy, but being enamoured of the naval life, his brother was a captain, he had bought a purser's place, and in spite of his club foot, he had distinguished himself in several desperate cutting-out expeditions. He was always on deck, understood the manoeuvres perfectly, and prided himself on sailing a boat. He knew a great deal about the sea, and although he was not a particularly good purser, he was an honest one, an uncommon bird. Pullings was much as he had always been, a thin, amiable, loose-limbed youth, delighted to be a lieutenant, his highest ambition, delighted to be in the same ship as Captain Aubrey. How did he manage to remain so tubular, eating with the thoughtless avidity of a wolf? Harrowby, the master, a broad, spade-shaped face set in a smile. He was smiling now, with his wide mouth open at the corners, the middle closed. It gave an impression of falsity, perhaps unfairly, for although the master was an ignorant, confident man, there might be no conscious duplicity there. No teeth. A fair receding hair worn cropped. A vast domed forehead, ordinarily pale, now red and beaded with sweat. An indifferent navigator, it seemed. He owed his advance to Gambier, that evangelical admiral, and when ashore he was a lay preacher, belonging to some West Country sect. Stephen often saw him in the sick bay, coming to visit the invalids. "There is good in them all," he said. "We must try to bring them up to our level." Maturin. "How do you propose to effect this?" Harrowby. "I rely upon unction and personal magnetism." Yet he did in fact bring them wine and chicken. He wrote letters for them, and gave or lent small sums of money. He was ready and eager to give, perhaps readier than others to receive. Active, zealous, healthy, extremely clean, somewhat excited, he caught Stephen's eye and smiled wider, nodding kindly. Etheridge, the marine lieutenant, was as red as his coat. At the moment he was surreptitiously undoing his belt, looking round with a general benevolence. A small, round-headed man who rarely spoke, yet he gave no impression of taciturnity. His lively expression and his frequent laugh took the place of conversation. He had indeed very little to say, but he was welcome wherever he went. Nichols. He was something else again. The only comparatively pale face in the cheerful ring, a black-haired man, self-contained, not one to be pushed about. He would have been the skeleton at this orderly, somewhat formal feast if he had not been making an obvious effort at conviviality. But his face was set in unhappiness, and his present application to the port did not seem to be doing him much good. Stephen had seen much of him in Gibraltar years before, and they had dined together with the 42nd foot at Chatham, when Nichols had had to be carried back to his ship, singing like a canary bird. But that was immediately before his marriage, and no doubt he was in a state of nervous tension. In those days, Stephen had thought him a typical sea officer, somewhat reserved but good company, one of those who naturally combined good breeding with the necessary roughness of their profession, with a bulkhead between the two. Typical sea officer. The phrase was not without meaning, but how to define it? In every gathering of sailors you would see a few from whom the rest seemed variants, but how few to colour a whole profession? To colour it. To set its tone. Offhand, he could not think of more than a dozen out of the hundreds he had met. Dundas, Rew, Seymour, Jack. Perhaps Cochrane. But no, Cochrane ashore was too flamboyant to be typical, too full of himself, too conscious of his own value, too much affected by that Scotch love of a grievance. And there was that unfortunate title hanging about his neck, a beloved millstone. There was something of Cochrane in Jack, a restless impatience of authority, a strong persuasion of being in the right, but not enough to disqualify him, not nearly enough. And in any case it had been diminishing fast these last years. What were the constants? A cheerful resilience, a competent readiness, an open conversability, a certain candour. How much of this was the sea, the common stimuli? How much was the profession the choice of those who shared a particular cast of mind? "The captain is underway," whispered his neighbour, touching his shoulder and bending to speak in his ear. "Why, so he is," said Stephen, getting to his feet. "He has catted his fish." They slowly climbed the companion ladder. The heat on deck was even greater than below now that the breeze had died away entirely. On the larboard side a sail had been lowered into the water, buoyed on its extremities, and weighted in the middle to form a swimming bath, and half the ship's company were splashing about in it. To starboard, perhaps 2 miles away, lay the rocks, no longer anything like ships at all, but still dazzling white from the edge of the deep blue sea to their tops, some 50 feet above the surface in the case of the biggest, so white that the slow surf showed creamy in comparison. A cloud of gannets sailed overhead, with a mingling of dark, smaller terns. Every now and then a gannet dived straight down into the sea, with a splash like a 4-pounder ball. "Mr. Babington, pray lend me your spyglass," cried Stephen. And when he had gazed for a while, "Oh, how I wish I were there! Jack, that is to say, Captain Aubrey, may I have a boat?"
"My dear doctor," said Jack, "I am sure you would not have asked if you had remembered it was Sunday afternoon."
Sunday afternoon was holy. It was the men's only holiday, wind, weather, and the malice of the enemy permitting, and they prepared for it with enormous labour on Saturday and Sunday morning.
"Now I must go below and see to that infernal sail-room," he said, turning quickly away from his friend's disappointment. "You will not forget that we are to call upon Mr. Stanhope before quarters."
"I will pull you across, if you choose," said Nichols a moment later. "I am sure Hervey will let us have the jolly boat."
"How very good-natured of you," cried Stephen, looking into Nichols's face, somewhat Venus but perfectly in command of himself. "I shall be infinitely obliged. Give me leave to fetch a hammer, some small boxes, a hat, and I am with you."
They crawled along the barge, the launch, and one of the cutters to the jolly boat, that were all towing behind to prevent them opening in the heat, and rowed away. The cheerful noise faded behind them. Their wake lengthened across the glassy sea. Stephen took off his clothes and sat naked in his sennet hat. He revelled in the heat, and this had been his daily practice since the latitude of Madeira. At present he was a disagreeable mottled dun colour from head to foot, the initial brown having darkened to a suffused grey. He was not much given to washing. Fresh water was not to be had in any event, and the salt from his swimming lay upon him like dust.
"I was contemplating upon sea officers just now," he observed, "and trying to name the qualities that make one cry, 'That man is a sailor in the meliorative sense.' From that I went on to reflect that the typical sea officer is as rare as your anatomically typical corpse. That is to say, he is surrounded by what, for want of a better word, I may call unsatisfactory specimens, or subspecies. And I was carried on to the reflection that whereas there are many good, or at least amiable midshipmen, there are fewer good lieutenants, still fewer good captains, and almost no good admirals. A possible explanation may be this.
In addition to professional competence, cheerful resignation, an excellent liver, natural authority, and 100 other virtues, there must be the far rarer quality of resisting the effects, the dehumanizing effects, of the exercise of authority. Authority is a solvent of humanity. Look at any husband, any father of a family, and note the absorption of the person by the persona, the individual by the role. Then multiply the family and the authority by some hundreds, and see the effect upon a sea captain, to say nothing of an absolute monarch. Surely man in general is born to be oppressed or solitary, if he is to be fully human, unless it so happens that he is immune to the poison. In the nature of the service, this immunity cannot be detected until late, but it certainly exists. How, otherwise, are we to account for the rare but fully human and therefore efficient admirals we see, such as Duncan, Nelson? He saw that Nichols's attention had wandered, and he let his voice die away to a murmur with no apparent end, took a book from his coat pocket, and, since the nearer sky was empty of birds, fell to reading in it. The oars squeaked against the tholes, the blades dipped with a steady beat, and the sun beat down. The boat crept across the water. From time to time, Stephen looked up, repeating his Urdu phrases and considering Nichols's face. The man was in a bad way, and had been for some time. Bad at Gibraltar, bad at Madeira, worse since St. Jago. Scurvy was out of the question in this case. Syphilis? Worms?
"I beg your pardon," said Nichols with an artificial smile. "I'm afraid I lost the thread. What were you saying?"
"I was repeating phrases from this little book. It is all I could get, apart from the Fort William grammar, which is in my cabin. It is a phrase book, and I believe it must have been compiled by a disappointed man. My horse has been eaten by a tiger, leopard, bear. I wish to hire a palanquin. There are no palanquins in this town, sir. All my money has been stolen. I wish to speak to the collector. The collector is dead, sir. I have been beaten by evil men. Yet salacious, too, poor burning soul. Woman, wilt thou lie with me?"
With an effort at civil interest, Nichols said,
"Is that the language you speak with Ahmed?"
"Yes, indeed, all our Lascars speak it, although they come from widely different parts of India. It is their lingua franca. I chose Ahmed because it is his mother tongue, and he is an obliging, patient fellow. But he cannot read or write, and that is why I ply my grammar in the hope of fixing the colloquial. Do you not find that a spoken language wafts in and out of your mind, leaving little trace unless you anchor it with print?"
"I can't say I do. I'm no hand at talking foreign, never was. It quite astonishes me to hear you rattling away with those black men. Even in English, when it comes to anything more delicate than making sail, I find it—"
He paused, looked over his shoulder and said there was no landing this side, it was too steep too, but they might do better on the other. The number of birds had been increasing as they neared the rock, and now as they pulled round to its southern side, the terns and boobies were thick overhead, flying in and out from their fishing grounds in a bewildering intricacy of crossing paths, the birds all strangely mute. Stephen gazed up into them, equally silent, lost in admiration, until the boat grounded on weed-muffled rock and tilted as Nichols ran it up into a sheltered inlet, heaved it clear of the swell, and handed Stephen out.
"Thank you, thank you," said Stephen, scrambling up the dark, sea-washed band to the shining white surface beyond.
And there he stopped dead. Immediately in front of his nose, almost touching it, there was a sitting booby. 2, 4. 6 boobies, as white as the bare rock they sat on, a carpet of boobies, young and old, and among them quantities of terns. The nearest booby looked at him without much interest. A slight degree of irritation was all he could detect in that long reptilian face and bright round eye. He advanced his finger and touched the bird, which shrugged its person. And as he did so, a great rush of wings filled the air, another booby landing with a full crop for its huge gaping child on the naked rock a few feet away.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," he murmured,
straightening to survey the island, a smooth mound like a vast worn molar tooth, with birds thick in all the hollows. The hot air was full of their sound, coming and going, full of the ammoniac smell of their droppings and the reek of fish,
and all over the hard white surface it shimmered in the heat and the intolerable glare, so that birds 50 yards up the slope could hardly be focused, and the ridge of the mound wavered like a taut rope that had been plucked. Waterless, totally arid. Not a blade of grass, not a weed, not a lichen. Stench, blazing rock, and unmoving air. "This is a paradise!" cried Stephen.
"I'm glad you like it," said Nichols, sitting wearily down on the only clean spot he could find. "You don't find it rather strong for paradise? And hellfire hot? The rock is burning through my shoes."
"There is an odour, sure," said Stephen. "But by paradise I mean the tameness of the fowl, and I do not believe it is they that smell." He ducked as a tern shot past his head, banking and breaking hard to land. "The tameness of the birds before the fall. I believe this bird will suffer me to smell it. I believe that much, if not all, the odour is that of excrement, dead fish and weed." He moved a little closer to the booby, one of the few still sitting on an egg, knelt by it, gently took its wicked beak and put his nose to its back. "They contribute a good deal, however," he said. The booby looked indignant, ruffled, impenetrably stupid. It uttered a low hiss, but it did not move away, merely shuffled the egg beneath it and stared at a crab that was laboriously stealing a flying fish left by a tern at the edge of a nest 2 feet away. From the top of the island he could see the frigate, lying motionless 2 miles off, her sails slack and dispirited. He had left Nichols under a shelter made from their clothes spread on the oars, the only patch of shade on this whole marvellous rock. He had collected 2 boobies and 2 terns. He had had to overcome an extreme reluctance to knock them on the head, but one of the boobies, the red-legged booby, was almost certainly of an undescribed species. He had chosen birds that were not breeding, and by his estimate of this rock alone there were some 35,000 left. He had filled his boxes with several specimens of a feather-eating moth, a beetle of an unknown genus, 2 woodlice apparently identical with those from an Irish turf stack, the agile thievish crab, and a large number of ticks and wingless flies that he would classify in time. Such a haul! And now he was beating the rock with his hammer, not for geological specimens, for they were already piled in the boat, but to widen a crevice in which an unidentified arachnid had taken refuge. The rock was hard, the crevice deep, the arachnid stubborn. From time to time he paused to breathe the somewhat purer air up here, and to look out towards the ship. Eastwards there were far fewer birds, though here and there a gannet cruised or dived with closed wings, plummeting into the sea. When he dissected these specimens, he should pay particular attention to their nostrils. There might well be a process that prevented the inrush of water. Nichols. The flow, the burst of confidence, hinging upon what chance word? Something tolerably remote, since he could not remember it, had led to the abrupt statement, "I was ashore from the time Euryalus paid off until I was appointed to the Surprise, and I had a disagreement with my wife." Protestants often confessed to medical men, and Stephen had heard this history before, always with a ritual plea for advice, the bitterly wounded wife, the wretched husband trying to atone, the civil imitation of a married life, the guarded words, politeness, restraint, resentment, the blank misery of nights and waking, the progressive decay of all friendship and communication. But he had never heard it expressed with such piercing, desolate unhappiness.
"I had thought it might be better when I was afloat," said Nichols, "but it was not. Then no letter at Gibraltar, although Leopard was there before us, and Swiftsure. Every time I had the middle watch I used to walk up and down, composing the answer I should send to the letters that would be waiting for me at Madeira. There were no letters. The packet had come and gone a fortnight before, while we were still in Gibraltar, and there were no letters. I had really thought there must be a remaining. But, however, not so much as a note. I could not believe it all the way down the trades. But now I do. And I tell you, Maturin, I cannot bear it. Not this long, slow death."
"There is certain to be a whole bundle of them at Rio," said Stephen. "I, too, received none at Madeira, virtually none. They are sure to be sent to Rio, rely upon it, or even to Bombay."
"No," said Nichols, with a toneless certainty, "there will be no letters any more. I have bored you too long with my affairs, forgive me.
"'If I were to rig a shelter with the oars and my shirt, "'would you like to sit down under it? "'Surely this heat will give you a sunstroke.'
"'No, I thank you. "'Time is all too short. "'I must quickly explore this stationary ark. "'The dear knows when I shall see it again.'
"'Stephen hoped Nichols would not resent it later. "'Regular confession was far more formal, "'far less detailed and spreading, "'far less satisfactory than its unsacramental aspect.' But at least a confessor was a priest his whole life through, whereas a doctor was an ordinary being, much of the time, difficult to face over the dinner table after such privities. He returned to his task. Thump, thump, thump. Pause. Thump, thump, thump. And as the crevice slowly widened, he noticed great drops falling on the rock, drying as they fell. I should not have thought I had any sweat left, he reflected, thumping on. Then he realized the drops were also falling on his back. Huge drops of warm rain, quite unlike the dung the countless birds had gratified him with. He stood up, looked round, and there, barring the western sky, was a darkness, and on the sea beneath it a white line approaching with inconceivable rapidity. No birds in the air, even on the crowded western side, and the middle distance was blurred by flying rain. The whole of the darkness was lit from within by red lightning, plain even in this glare. A moment later the sun was swallowed up, and in the hot gloom water hurtled down upon him. Not drops, but jets, as warm as the air, and driving flatways with enormous force, and between the close-packed jets a spray of shattered water infinitely divided, so thick he could hardly draw in the air. He sheltered his mouth with his hands, breathed easier, let water gush through his fingers and drank it up, pint after pint. Although he was on the dome of the rock, the deluge covered his ankles, and there were his boxes blowing, floating away. Staggering and crouching in the wind, he recovered too and squatted over them, and all the time the rain raced through the air, filling his ears with a roar that almost drowned the prodigious thunder. Now the squall was right overhead. The turning wind knocked him down, and what he had thought the ultimate degree of cataclysm increased tenfold. He wedged the boxes between his knees and crouched on all fours. Time took on another aspect. It was marked only by the successive lightning strokes that hissed through the air, darting from the cloud above, striking the rock and leaping back into the darkness. A few weak, stunned thoughts moved through his mind. What of the ship? Can any bird survive this? Is Nichols safe? It was over. The rain stopped instantly, and the wind swept the air clear. A few minutes later the cloud had passed from the lowering sun, and it rode there, blazing from a perfect, even bluer sky. To westward the world was unchanged, just as it always had been apart from white caps on the sea. To the east the squall still covered the place he had last seen the ship, and in the widening sunlit stretch between the rock and the darkness a current bore a stream of fledgling birds, hundreds of them, and all along the stream he saw sharks, some large, some small, rising to the bodies. The whole rock was still streaming, the sound of running water everywhere. He splashed down the slope calling, "Nichols! Nichols!" Some of the birds, he had to avoid them as he stepped, were still crouching flat over their eggs or nestlings. Some were preening themselves. In three places there were jagged rows of dead terns and gannets, charred, though damp, and smelling of the fire. He reached the spot where the shelter had been. No shelter. No fallen oars. And where they had hauled up the boat, there was no boat. He made his way clean round the rock, leaning on the wind and calling in the emptiness. And when for the second time he came to the eastern side and looked out to sea, the squall had vanished. There was no ship to be seen. Climbing to the top, he caught sight of her, hull down and scudding before the wind under her topsail, her mizzen and main topmast gone. He watched until even the flicker of white disappeared. The sun had dipped below the horizon when he turned and walked down. The boobies had already set to their fishing again, and the higher birds were still in the sun, flashing pink, as they dived through the fiery light.